It's time for the Des Moines Register on Thursday, March 28. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. My name is Twyla Glenn, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Linda Lundgren. Excuse me. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinion, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners just like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer Voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and the headlines from today's Des Moines Register. AccuWeather says across the state it will be partly sunny and milder today, however, increasing clouds in the north, winds south-southeast 7 to 14 miles per hour. And the forecast through the weekend for central Iowa looks like this. Today, it should be partly sunny, pleasant, and milder, with winds south-southeast 7 to 14 miles per hour. It will be considerably more cloudy this evening and overnight. High today, 60, low 40. On Friday, mostly cloudy and mild with a high of 67 and a low of 39. On Saturday, times of clouds and sun with a high of 60 and a low of 39. And on Easter Sunday, cloudy and a shower and cooler with a high of 55 and a low of 42. Looking at the precipitation in the 24 hours through 4 p.m. on Wednesday, there was zero precipitation. Our month-to-date is 2.38 inches against a normal of 1.81 inches. Our year-to-date, we've had 4.71 inches of precipitation against a normal of 4.29 inches. Last year, on this date, we had seen 4.98 inches of precipitation. Sunrise today, 7:04 a.m. Sunset tonight, 7:36 p.m. Moonrise today, 11:23 p.m. Moonset today, 8:24 a.m. Now turning to the front page of the Des Moines Register, the lead story is identified with the headline, A Win or an Attack. Both the win and the attack are in quotation marks. Reynolds signs an AEA overhaul and teacher pay raise measures into law. Basketball, they say, is not the only obsession for the Cyclones, and missing bridge workers are presumed dead. Now here with the first story is Linda.
Well, I'll read about the new AEA law. Governor Kim Reynolds has signed a far-reaching education law restructuring funding for the state's area education agencies, raising starting teacher pay to $50,000 and giving Iowa schools a 2.5% funding increase for the coming year. Reynolds, a Republican, signed the education package in a ceremony Wednesday afternoon in the governor's office in the Iowa State Capitol building in Des Moines. The law, House File 2612, contains the top education priorities Reynolds laid out in her Condition of the State address in January. House File 2612 will improve special education for students with disabilities and raise salaries for new and experienced teachers, two foundational pillars of a world-class education system, which is exactly what we strive to provide for every student in our state, Reynolds said. It gives school districts control over pools of state funding that now go to the AEAs for general education and media services, allowing them to spend the money on private vendors or continue working with the AEAs under a fee-for-service model. The AEAs, currently the sole provider of special education services, will continue receiving 90% of the state funding that they currently receive for special education, while school districts will control the remaining 10%. The bill has been highly controversial. Education advocates organized protests at the Capitol and the governor's mansion in opposition to the bill. Parents of students with disabilities showed up at legislative hearings, saying they believe the legislation would harm the services that their children receive. and Democrats vowed to make the legislation a campaign issue in this fall's elections. House Minority Leader Jennifer Confrist, a Democrat of Windsor Heights, told reporters that Reynolds' celebration of the bill shows that she's completely out of touch with Iowans. "When you look at the celebration she's having, I want you to think about the families who have so much uncertainty now as they're wondering what will happen to the services in their communities, what will happen to their kids who are getting AEA services," she said. "There are so many questions." Some superintendents have argued for giving school districts more control over the money so they can better tailor services to their students' needs. The legislation makes several changes to how the AEAs are funded and whether school districts must continue using the agencies for certain services. The AEAs are funded through a combination of state, federal, and local property tax dollars. They offer special education services to school districts, as well as media services and general education services. The law does not make any changes to funding for special education in the 2024-25 school year. In the 2025-26 school year and beyond, districts will receive the state special education funding that goes to the AEAs, but they would be required to send 90% of that money to the AEAs while keeping the remaining 10%. The AEAs received about $156 million in special education funding from the state during the current fiscal year, according to an analysis of the bill by the nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency. Special education funding will continue to go to the AEAs. The law also gradually gives school districts control over all the state money for media services and general education services that AEAs now receive. In the 2024-25 school year, school districts will receive 60% of the media and general education services funding, and AEAs will receive 40%. Schools can choose whether to continue contracting with the AEAs for those services under a fee-for-service model or use a private provider. Beginning the following year, school districts will receive all the state funding for media and general education services and can choose whether to use the AEAs. The AEAs currently receive about $35.7 million for general education services and $32.3 million for media services, according to the bill analysis. The law authorizes the Department of Education to create a division of special education with 13 new staff members in Des Moines and another 40 who will be based within AEAs around the state. The law also creates a task force to study and make recommendations on the AEA system. The group must submit a report with its findings to the Iowa legislature by December 31st. Pay for AEA administrators will not be allowed to exceed 125% of the average salary of the superintendents within their AEA region. A Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll conducted in late February found a majority of Iowans, 56%, have a favorable view of the AEAs, while 24% viewed them unfavorably, and 20% are not sure. The legislation raises minimum pay for beginning teachers to $47,500 in the coming school year and to $50,000 the following year, up from $33,500 under the current law. It sets a minimum salary of $60,000 for teachers with at least 12 years of experience in the coming school year, before raising that minimum to $62,000 the next year. And the law has $22 million for schools to use to raise experienced teacher pay and another $14 million to increase pay for non-salaried school staff, like paraeducators. Iowa currently ranks in the bottom half of states for starting teacher pay, and with this increase, we soar to the top five in the nation, Reynolds said. But even better than our ranking is the message it sends to current and prospective teachers. Iowa values education and those who dedicate their careers to students, and their pay should absolutely reflect it. The Iowa poll found 76% of Iowans favor raising minimum teacher pay to $50,000 per year. The law also increases state per pupil aid to schools by 2.5%. An increase of $191 per pupil, bringing total state funding for public K-12 schools to $3.8 billion. The state also is expected to spend $179.2 million in the upcoming year on private school education savings accounts. Reynolds said she's traveled around the state to meet with superintendents and other representatives of about 150 school districts on the bill, including supporters and opponents. Everyone was willing to come to the table with their questions, their concerns, and their ideas. And I'm proud to say that actually much of their feedback is reflected in the final bill, she said. So I want to thank everyone who took the time to meet with me. That input made a difference, and I believe that your students will be better served because of your involvement in the process. Representative Skylar Wheeler, Republican from Hull, the House Education Committee chair, said at Wednesday's bill signing that Republicans, quote, brought everybody to the table to discuss the bill. We held numerous meetings with everyone and worked with all sides to come to an agreement that is a win for education in our state, he said. Senate Minority Leader Pam Jochim, Democrat of Dubuque, released a statement thanking the Iowans who spoke out against the bill, saying Reynolds failed to listen to their concerns. Governor Reynolds demanded an attack on Iowa's area education agencies that no one asked for and no one wanted. She bullied it through the Republican-led legislature, and today she signed it into law, Jochim said. Every step of the way, Iowans told her to stop, to slow down, to engage stakeholders, and collaborate on real improvements to special education in Iowa. She never listened, and now parents and children will face the consequences.
And before we return to the front page, let's look at this article entitled How Lawmakers Voted on the AEA and Teacher Pay Bill. A controversial bill overhauling Iowa's education agencies has been signed by Governor Kim Reynolds after recent votes in the Iowa House and Senate. House File 2612 makes several changes on how the AEAs are funded and whether school districts must continue using the agencies for certain services. The AEAs, currently the sole provider of special education services, would continue receiving 90% of the state funding that they currently receive, while school districts would control the remaining 10%. The legislation will give school districts control over all the state money for media and general education services that now goes to the AEAs, allowing them to spend the funding on private vendors or continue working with the AEAs under a fee-for-service model. Minimum pay for beginning teachers will increase to $50,000 per year, up from $33,500 under the bill, which also includes new state money for schools to raise experienced teachers' salaries and increase pay for non-salaried school staff. The bill also increases state per pupil aid to schools by 2.5%, an increase of $191 per pupil, bringing total state funding for public K through 12 schools to $3.8 billion. Reynolds proposed those changes in January. So here is how lawmakers voted. House lawmakers voted 51 to 43 on March 21 to pass the bill. Democrats were joined in opposition by 9 Republicans, Representative Eddie Andrews of Johnston, Mark Cisneros of Muscatine, Zach Deacon of Granville, Martin Graber of Fort Madison, Thomas Jennery of Lamars, Brian Losey of Bondurant, Gary Moore of Bettendorf, Ray Sorensen of Greenfield, and Charlie Thompson of Charles City. Those were the only Republicans who voted against the bill. All Democrats voted against them. Now, this article includes a list of all those names, but rather than reading those names individually, let me just repeat that every Democrat in the House voted against this bill. So if your representative was a Democrat, you can know that he or she voted against it. All Republicans voted for the bill, except for those 9 whose names I just read: Andrews, Jennery, Graber, Cisneros, Deacon, Losey, Moore, Sorensen, and Charlie Thompson. 6 representatives were absent from that voting. Excused from the voting were Forbes, a Democrat, Gaines, a Democrat, Golding, a Republican, Gustaf, a Republican, Jones, a Republican, and Osmundson, also a Republican. So over in the Senate voted 30 to 18 on March 26 to pass the bill, sending it to Reynolds for her signature. 3 Republicans joined the Democrats in opposition. Again, all the Democrats voted against this bill. All Republicans voted for it, except Waylon Brown of Osage, Mike Klemisch of Spillville, and Charlie McClintock of Alburnett. So all Republicans, except those that I just named, voted in favor of the bill, and all Democrats voted against it. 2 senators were not present. Senators Salmon, a Republican, and Walz, a Democrat, were excused.
Missing bridge workers presumed dead. Recovery operation begins. The NTSB takes over investigation of disaster. This is from Baltimore. Authorities were searching Wednesday for the bodies of 6 construction workers who were on the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore when it was struck by a cargo ship and collapsed into the Patapsco River. The Dolly, a Singapore-flagged cargo vessel, lost power early Tuesday before colliding with a support column of the bridge, the second longest continuous truss bridge span in the world, officials said. Though a mayday gave authorities on the ground time to halt traffic, 8 construction workers on the bridge plunged into the river when the ship struck. Authorities rescued 2 people before officials called off a massive search Tuesday that used divers, helicopters, and sonar from dozens of agencies. The missing workers were presumed dead based on the temperature of the water and the amount of time that had elapsed. The recovery effort resumed Wednesday after a pause overnight because of a strong current and low visibility. The Maryland Transportation Authority told USA Today there were multiple vehicles on the bridge at the time of the collision, and that it is believed they all belonged to the construction workers. A Baltimore nonprofit identified as a father of 3 from El Salvador as one of the 6 missing construction workers. In a news release, CASA said Miguel Luna, who has lived in Maryland for over 19 years, didn't return home after he left for work on Monday around 6:30 p.m. He was a longtime member of CASA, a nonprofit day worker center that provides assistance for workers and immigrant families. Providing a humanitarian support during this crisis is the priority as families navigate this tragedy and seek answers about their missing loved ones, Gustavo Torres, CASA's executive director, said in a statement. The entire Baltimore region and CASA family is lamenting this tragedy. Maynor Yasir Suazo Sandoval, 38, a Honduran national who arrived in the U.S. about 2 decades ago, is also among the missing, according to Wilson Paz, Director General of the Protection of Honduran Migrants. Honduran officials made contact with Suazo Sandoval's brother in Honduras and another sibling in the U.S. In a Wednesday morning news conference, Mexican President Andre Manuel Lopez Obrador said 3 Mexicans were involved in the bridge collapse, according to the country's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. 1 Mexican national was rescued and treated for his injuries, while 2 others remain missing. The Guatemalan Ministry of Foreign Affairs confirmed 2 Guatemalan nationals, ages 26 and 35, went missing while working on the bridge, but did not release their names. The 8 workers were employed by Bronner Builders, a Maryland-based construction firm that is contracted by the Maryland Transportation Authority and several public agencies in the Baltimore area. The crew of 22 Indian nationals who were aboard the Dali cargo ship when it crashed into the Key Bridge had not left the vessel as of Wednesday morning. U.S. Coast Guard spokesperson Cynthia Oldham told USA Today. Officials on Tuesday said inspectors had to make sure it was safe to board the ship before the crew could be taken to shore, and investigators with the National Transportation Safety Board, which has assumed the investigation, could begin an on-site probe. NTSB investigators were able to board the Dolly on Tuesday night and were scheduled to begin interviewing crew members on Wednesday, CNN reported, citing Jennifer Homendy, the agency's chair. The investigation will also include interviews with officials who were on the bridge just before the crash and whether there were major deficiencies on the ship, according to Homendy. The agency is aware of the reported power issues on the cargo ship, Homendy said, which investigations will need to verify. A U.S. official who was not authorized to speak publicly told USA Today that the ship's power loss could be related to mechanical failure. The Dolly had been involved in at least 1 accident prior to Tuesday's crash. While the 9-year-old container ship had passed previous inspections, officials discovered a deficiency with its, quote, propulsion and auxiliary machinery, gauges, thermometers, etc., during an inspection in June at the port of San Antonio in Chile, according to the Tokyo MOU, an intergovernmental maritime authority in the Asia-Pacific region. Sources familiar with the investigation told the Wall Street Journal that investigators will examine whether contaminated fuel may have caused the ship's power issues. Joseph Barbera, an associate professor at George Washington University, whose research focuses on emergency and risk management, said it will likely take weeks before the massive cargo vessel can be cleared from the river. He said experts will have to conduct structural evaluations before deciding how best to move the ship so the massive chunks of steel can be taken out of the water. Inspectors will have to secure the fuel, determine the state of the engines, and decide whether they'd want to remove some of the containers to lessen the weight of the ship. He said if the engines don't work, they'll likely have to use tugboats to pull it out of the bridge column. That's going to be a significant undertaking, and then they have to be sure, once they free it up, that they can stabilize and control it, he said. This is a very complex operation. Vice Admiral Peter Gauthier, deputy commandant for operations for the U.S. Coast Guard, said the Dolly was carrying 4,700 cargo containers, including 56 with hazardous materials. Two containers fell into the river, Gauthier said, but added, the ones that are in the water do not contain hazardous materials. He also said the ones aboard do not present a threat to the public. Emergency management experts told USA Today that, though there are many questions that require answers before the vessel and debris can be removed from the river, it's clear that it will be a major challenge for authorities. Natalie Simpson, an operations management professor for the University at Buffalo, said much of the recovery process will likely be on hold while divers search for the bodies of the missing construction workers and assess the debris, a process complicated by the river's strong tide. You're looking at a very dangerous situation to work in right now, she said, adding that it will likely be several days before authorities can work on removing the ship. Simpson said experts will have to inspect the ship, especially its hull, which seems to have been damaged in the crash. If it can be stabilized, tugboats can possibly lug the ship to shore. However, Simpson said, this seems unlikely considering the intensity of the crash. If the ship can't be stabilized, authorities will have to summon specialized equipment, floating cranes, for example, to remove freight containers and the chunks of steel on the bow. If the news that comes up out of the water is the absolute best it could possibly be, I say it will take a couple of weeks before they can clear it, she said. I would be surprised if it took several months just to clear the channel.
Well, basketball is not the only obsession for the Cyclones team. This is actually datelined Boston, but it's written by Travis Hines of the Register, who is no doubt traveling with the Iowa State team during the NCAA tournament. The pure bliss and chaos of a championship celebration had settled into the quiet and dark of a coach bus and the impending 200-mile ride. Just hours earlier, the Iowa State University basketball team was accepting the Big Ten tournament trophy from the league commissioner, Brent Yormach. The Cyclones had just dismantled number one-ranked Houston by 28 points in the title game to cut down the T-Mobile Center nets and celebrated the program's sixth Big Ten tournament title. Then they shuffled onto the bus for the ride to Ames. A silence fell over the group as if they had a moment to reflect on what they had just accomplished. Or maybe they were just waiting for something. We exit T-Mobile, the gate shut behind us, and the first thing that the guys do, Iowa State Director of Basketball Operations Micah Byers said, is scream, "Send code." It's been a constant refrain for the Cyclones to begin a game of Among Us, a popular smartphone game that the team has become obsessed with, their words, over the last 2 months. I don't recall something that a team has been as hooked on as they are with that deal, said Iowa State coach T.J. Ostelberger. And he told the Register, they're locked in, they're playing it all the time. There's something, sometimes more energy on the bus than I might normally like, but it's a good thing they're all having fun together. The number 2 seed Cyclones have arrived at the Sweet 16 of the NCAA tournament to play number 3 Illinois on Thursday at 9:09 p.m. That will be shown on TBS. relying on the connectedness of a ferocious and dynamic defense and the togetherness of a selfless and balanced offense. They play a brand of basketball that demands cohesion. It might be a bit much to draw a line from becoming hooked on a game app to playing a truly team game, but for the Cyclones, it's become as routine as film work or shoot around. I don't know if it's done or if it does or does not contribute, Iowa State guard Curtis Jones said. There are probably good teams out there that don't like each other, but it definitely helps and it makes the time more enjoyable. Excuse me. Excuse me. Among Us gained popularity as the COVID-19 pandemic pushed much human-to-human interaction online. It's a multiplayer game probably best described as something akin to a murder mystery dinner theater. Up to 15 real-life players can participate in a single game, which is set in space. Crewmates are charged with fulfilling various tasks on their spacecraft, but among them, get it, are up to 3 imposters. The imposters are tasked with sabotaging the craft and killing off the crewmates without being discovered. The crewmates work to do their tasks while also uncovering the imposters. There is the ability to play along with strangers online or in an individually siloed game among friends, which requires a unique code to join. Thus, why Send Code has become the cue to get going. Every bus trip and every time we've had any downtime anywhere from stuck in an airport at TCU to wherever, Byers said, it's been the calling card. We get off the floor, win a big team game, everybody's elated. We get on the bus, there's about 10 seconds of silence, and all of a sudden they yell out, Send Code. The exact origins of how the game came to envelop the Cyclones is unclear. The best guess is it started with the student managers, but by the team's trip to BYU on January 16, it had taken hold. Everyone hopped on, started playing, freshman Milan Mosilovic said. Obviously, it was popular during COVID because there's not many things you could do during COVID, so everyone kind of knew how to play the game, but we kind of brought it back to life. Everyone loves it. Although, while they're playing, not everyone loves each other. When they're playing the game, they're collectively taking it as fierce, as serious as possible, Byers said. I've heard guys, and I won't even name names because I just hear voices, I never hear guys say mean things to each other, but just being accused of being an imposter is the angriest I've ever heard the guys interact with each other. The best part about it is that 5 times out of 10, they are the imposter, and they're offended their peers think they were, he said. There's also intense competition to be considered among the team's best Among Us players. The best crewmates, me, Demian Watson, for sure, Jones said, Cade Kelderman, good, Tamman Lipsky, good. They said Jackson Pavleski is getting better, but I'm not saying that, though. If you put that in there, I didn't say that. They say Pav is getting better. Me and Pav got a little rivalry going. Momsilovic, though, is considered the top imposter. The imposters don't get wins anymore, though, because everybody's starting to figure out everybody's game, Jones says. Milan's just been playing really well. Last weekend he got a few wins, and it's hard to get wins as imposter now. He got a few wins, and they were good wins. The trash talk among some of the most competitive people on the planet, as one might imagine, can get intense. One time a player, I'm not going to say who, was swearing someone out that it was them who was the imposter. They promised, Milosevic said. And then it wasn't them, so they got crucified because they were wrong, he added. While bonding over a game that was at the peak of its popularity years ago certainly has not won Iowa State any basketball games, it undeniably has kept them connected as a team in a time when it was much easier and common for players to isolate themselves. I realize this sounds corny and sounds like an old man, Byers said, but there were cell phones or before cell phones had games and before there were cell phones or before cell phones had games and it became a device you could watch movies on. That's what buses sounded like, the interaction. It was those barbershop conversation people had prior to having your own earphones in and being with your own devices. It brings back that era, so to me, I think it's cool because they all want to do it with each other, he said. Perhaps most important of all, it has been player-driven. everybody looks for all these ways, and sometimes it can feel artificial or forced when you say out that guys spend time together, Byers said. Because what does that really mean? Does it mean they use contrived something to make them spend time together? To me, it's the organic nature of how it happened. It connects all of them. The fact the guys are doing something organic that they wanted to do, it makes it 10 times better than if it was suggested, hey guys, here's an amazing way to bond. And they go, get out of here, go yell at the clouds. That, to me, is the best part of it. It's completely organic. They came up with it on their own, he said. For a program that preaches the importance of habits and the importance of every single thing they do in their day-to-day lives, it does stand out that this team chooses itself over the literal unlimited options to pass the time on a bus, plane, or hotel. Obviously, we're a really close team, Mosilovich said. We like each other, and Hitt's games just make it more vivid, I guess, that we like each other and play well with each other on the court because of the off-the-court activities we do. It shows we truly like each other. The season is so long. You're with these guys from June until now. It's so long, and to find things that to do that are fun, it's good, he said. It's also not the norm. Jones is at his third collegiate stop after stints at Indian Hills Community College and Buffalo, and this is the first time he's seen this level of off-court engagement. And it's not just the players. Team managers and support staff also participate and play the game against and with each other. It's very different, Jones said. I'm glad that we got it because it occupies time. The bus sometimes can be boring, and it's also a way to bring us all together doing certain things. It's a lot of laughs. It's a lot of jokes. We always joke with each other about who sucks, who's good, who's not. I've never done anything like it, but it's super fun, he said. So, too, is all the winning. While correlation is not causation, the Cyclones are 16-4 with a Big 12 tournament title and a Sweet 16 appearance since playing the game en masse. I think it's been great for our team chemistry, our bonding, Otzelberger said. They're playing it at dinner, on the buses. I don't know exactly how it all goes. I think someone's an imposter and they're trying to figure out who it is, but it's one way to do a great job connecting with each other. They're obviously into it, he said. So into it, sometimes it can create a slight traffic hazard. For every single bus driver that we have, every bus trip starts the exact way, same way, Byers said. They start the bus, we count the number of players, we're ready to pull out, bus driver cranks it up, we're about to pull up, the guy says, send code, and the first person goes, hold up, hold up, hold up, and every bus driver slams on their brake. It's a tradition of traditions. It's just somebody who hasn't gotten the code yet, or they didn't get in the game in time, he said. On the bus ride from Ames to Des Moines for the flight to Boston, the Cyclones played. When the Cyclones arrived and boarded the bus for dinner, more among us. When they beat Houston, among us. When they secured a spot in the Sweet 16, send code. They love that deal, Otzelberger said. We had games on TV on the way back from Omaha. We had the Illinois game and the Creighton-Oregon game. But you could tell their focus and attention. The game was in the background, and among us was the priority. I don't know who cut the net down during Among Us that night, but they probably remember who did. The Cyclones have a chance to cut down nets this weekend by reaching the program's first Final Four since 1944. It will take a collective effort that will have to put the Cyclones to as close to their ceiling as they have ever been. That effort will be required against the Illini and will surely be a necessity in the Elite Eight, where the NCAA tournament's top seed, UConn, will likely wait. The Cyclones will have to be at their best together. Whether they can achieve that remains to be seen. In the NCAA tournament and the Cyclones' world, not much is guaranteed, except one thing. We definitely going to play on that bus, Jones said.
Well, that is the conclusion of the front page stories on Register, so we'll move to the Metro section. High Rise aims to evict Pura Social Club of East Village building sites shooting. The East Village high-rise, the Lion Apartments, will attempt to evict bar and event space Pura Social Club after a shooting took place on the premises last weekend, according to a memo sent to the building's residents. We are scheduling a call with our attorney to strategize the eviction of the restaurant involved in this incident, said the Monday email signed by the Lyon Apartments property management team. Our goal is to ensure that any entity on our premises does not compromise the safety and peace of our community. The Sunday shooting, which left two hospitalized, occurred in Pura's parking lot, Des Moines Police spokesperson Sergeant Paul Parisik said. The property manager said in their memo it involved guests at the venue, though Pura's owner, Uriah Mixdorf, told the Des Moines Register the shooting actually happened across the street after security staff had cleared out the lot following their 1 a.m. closure. Until police roped off the intersection of East 5th and Lyon Streets, Mixdorf said he hadn't been aware that an altercation took place. It's unfortunate, it's tragic, but it's completely unfair, he said. If anybody knows me, my family, and my team, they know that we want to do nothing but provide a safe environment. We're not there to encourage bad behavior. The building's owner, Denver-based private investment group Verico, did not respond to requests for comment. However, the group hasn't been coy about its hopes to convert the building's remaining commercial space, convert the building's remaining commercial space into apartments. The 660 East 5th Street complex was a sparsely populated senior housing complex called Heather Manor before its 2015 conversion into a mixed-use building with 103 apartments and 5,000 square feet of commercial space. At 11 stories, according to Polk County Assessor records, it's the second tallest building in the East Village, only shorter than the Iowa Capitol. An inpatient clinic attached to the tower vacated when its lease expired a year after the conversion, allowing that portion to become 23 market-rate apartment units and 2,300 square feet of commercial space on the ground level. Some of that commercial space has been empty since Verco purchased the building in October 2022, Daniel Doyle, a representative of the group, told the Register in January. The managers since have worked to amend a development agreement with the city to allow a portion of the building's first floor to be converted into 7 apartments. The units could be available in April. I don't want to comment on anything currently going on, Doyle said in January when asked about the future of Pura Social Club. Whenever there's an opportunity for affordable housing, we want to play our part in it. In the memo, the group told tenants, quote, we are committed to taking all necessary steps to ensure the Lyon is a secure and welcoming environment for everyone. Mixdorf said he hadn't been aware of the memo. Nobody said anything to us, he said. Pura opened 2 years ago in May in a space with floor-to-ceiling windows that provide a Des Moines skyline view. Faced with a decline in business, Mixdorf converted the cocktail bar and lounge into an event space in November. They've hosted shows, private dinners, parties, and rehearsals, as well as rented out their kitchen. Since then, Mixdorf said, Pura's only had one other incident where police had to be contacted after a group refused to leave at closing time. Staff pat down or check over guests with a handheld metal detector before entry, he added. It also has unarmed security guards inside and outside the venue as needed. After the shooting Sunday, he said, he and his wife received messages on social media and voicemails making them out to be, quote, deviants. They're comparing us to Zora, Mixdorf said, speaking of the notorious now-closed bar on Ingersoll Avenue, which the city sued as a public nuisance. Wait a minute, he said. Zora had 75 police calls in a single year. We had no calls. It's very upsetting.
The Hotel Fort Des Moines faces a pair of lawsuits. Managers at downtown's luxuriously renovated Hotel Fort Des Moines have been committing or condoning harassment and discrimination against their workers, two recent lawsuits claim. The downtown Des Moines landmark, which opened in 2021 after a multi-year $50 million restoration project, intended to return it to its original 1919 grandeur, operates under the boutique Curio Collection by the Hilton brand. Two recent lawsuits, one filed in November and the other in January, accuse the hotel's management of turning a blind eye or actively retaliating against employees who complained about sexuality and racially tinged misconduct. Both cases have now been transferred to federal court, where the defendants have filed motions to dismiss. It is hard to understand how conduct of this kind can be allowed to continue in Des Moines in 2023, attorney Roxanne Conlon, who's representing both plaintiffs, told the Register. Shame on the companies that do not stop it, she said. Hilton Hotels International declined to comment. It has filed motions to dismiss, arguing that it has no connection to the cases other than licensing its brand to the hotel. Attorneys for the hotel management group and employees, who also have filed motions to dismiss parts of the case, did not respond to a request for a comment. Sydney LaLore, a former maintenance worker at the hotel, claims she was subjected to pervasive sexual harassment and unwanted touching by her boss, Director of Engineering Brad Johnson. Hired in 2022, LaLore claims Johnson began making sexual comments and physical conduct after about a week after she was transferred to work under him. Her manager, according to the lawsuit, would consistently find any excuse to touch her back, stomach, thighs, shoulder, and butt, end quote, peppered her with innuendo and inappropriate jokes and invitations for dates, telling her that she was in every man's so-called wet dream. LaLore filed human resources complaints in May and July of 2022 that resulted in a short suspension for Johnson. She claims that on his return, though, he treated the discipline as a joke and continued harassing her, frequently telling her that he was HR's worst nightmare, quoting again from the lawsuit. She says Operations Director Neil Upadhyay and Human Resources Director Kyle Mariani told her they lacked evidence to fire Johnson, despite having refused to listen to recordings she offered them. Eventually, she says she was offered a chance to get away from him by moving to two other Des Moines Metro hotels owned by the same company, but found her new work duties amounted to a demotion. She is suing for sex discrimination as well as assault and battery for the unwanted touching. Troy Tyler, a black former security guard at the hotel, claims in his complaint that managers failed to put a stop to unceasing racial harassment from a coworker. Like LaLore, Tyler was hired in 2022. He alleges that Carrie Blanchard, a lobby attendant at the hotel, soon began making false accusations against him, including that he was watching and following her around the hotel to intimidate her. And as with LaLore, Tyler alleges managers sought to address the issue by changing his work schedule. He also says Mariani admitted the other employee was creating what was called a hostile work environment for him. Even so, he says in the suit, managers failed to discipline Blanchard, even after she had falsely yelled that he was sexually assaulting three people. Instead, he claims they told him he needed to leave before his shift ended in order to avoid encountering her. Tyler also alleges he was given the duties of security manager, but not the associated pay raise promised in his interview for the job, and that officials retaliated against him for encouraging Laylor to report the abuse against her. Ultimately, he says, both he and Blanchard were fired. The lobby attendant was then hired back with back pay, while he was not, he said. Tyler claims Blanchard's harassment was due to his race and alleges violation of state and federal anti-discrimination laws. In their complaints, Tyler and Laylor name several corporate entities. In motions to dismiss, the companies argue they should be dismissed from the complaint because the two have failed to sue the corporate subsidiary for whom they actually worked. In addition, they argue that Tyler's complaint describes what's called a personal conflict with a coworker and offers no facts supporting his claims the lobby attendant's actions were motivated by race. As for Laylor, they argue that her assault and battery claims must be addressed through a workers' compensation claim rather than litigation.
Lime Lounge lawsuit over liquor license fails. Iowa's highest court says the city of Des Moines was within its right to revoke a now-shuttered East Village nightclub's liquor license. Owners of the former Lime Lounge, brothers George and Cornelius Qualley, filed lawsuits in Polk County District Court in 2019 seeking to block the city's attempt to close their club. The Qualleys, who sought at least $12.5 million in damages, asked a judge to nullify Des Moines' ordinance that requires bars to obtain a conditional use permit to secure a liquor license. Bars and nightclubs in the city that don't serve food are required to secure a permit before serving alcohol. The Qualleys, who were fighting the ordinance that was used to revoke the permit, said the ordinance was a violation of equal protection and created illegal spot zoning, and compared some city staff to schoolyard bullies determined to see their club closed in the original lawsuit, which worked its way up to the Iowa Supreme Court. Last week, the Supreme Court affirmed the Court of Appeals and the District Court's judgments dismissing the bar's challenge that's part of a years-long dispute between the city and the bar's owners over noise complaints and violent incidents at or near the nightclub. In the opinion filed March 22nd, Justice Thomas Waterman wrote each of the bar's claims failed and that the city's ordinance is a proper exercise of the city's zoning authority expressly permitted under the law. We are disappointed but unfortunately not surprised by the court's unwillingness to follow its own clear precedent and instead issue a weak-kneed opinion that only serves to uphold increasing government overreach to the detriment of all Iowans, the bar owners wrote in an emailed statement to the Des Moines Register. While there has been a significant change in zoning laws since the litigation, the legal action taken speaks to a larger problem in Des Moines, the owners said. Rather than support its business community and take steps to build a thriving economy, city leaders choose to engage in multi-year legal battles that cost businesses and taxpayers alike enormous amounts of time and money, while some of the city's most valuable commercial real estate in the downtown and Ingersoll Avenue corridor stands vacant. In an emailed statement to the Register, Des Moines City Manager Scott Sanders said the city is pleased with the Supreme Court's opinion to reject the Lime Lounge's contention that the city's zoning ordinances could not be applied to liquor establishments, and also finding the city properly applied the law in its dealings with the bar. The nightclub that brought an eclectic range of DJs and cocktails to Des Moines first opened on Ingersoll Avenue in 2009 and later moved to the East Village at 435 East Grand Avenue in 2011, doubling the size of its space. The 1,700-square-foot bar was known for its intimate dance floor, patio space, and list of specialty cocktails. The nightclub closed its doors in late 2019 after two shootings that occurred outside within a two-week period, which police alleged were preceded by disputes inside the Lime Lounge. Following the shootings, Des Moines city officials and police claimed the bar was a troublesome spot dating back several years. The Qualley brothers alleged the police and city officials unfairly scrutinized and condemned the bar, resulting in financial losses. The brothers filed two lawsuits, one regarding the ordinance and the second alleging libel, defamation, and conspiracy on the part of the city and its employees. The second lawsuit was transferred to the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit, where justices sided with the district court that the brothers' arguments should be dismissed. Despite the Supreme Court's latest opinion, the tension between the city and the Qualleys has brewed over into the brothers' more recent venture, Nightingale Cocktail, a bar now housed in the same spot as the former Lime Lounge. The brothers filed a lawsuit in May against the city, citing defamation and civil conspiracy. The latest lawsuit claims the city wrote false statements about them and their bar in a letter sent to the media, Des Moines City Council members, and the Iowa Alcoholic Beverages Division when they applied for a liquor license. The liquor license ultimately was approved, but the Qualleys claim in their lawsuit the city manager continued to disparage them. In an email, Sanders said the city is evaluating its next step in ongoing litigation and will proceed accordingly. The case currently is in Polk County District Court.
Waterloo police kill a man who allegedly pointed a gun. The Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation is investigating an officer-involved shooting that left one dead after a man allegedly threatened an auto body shop in Waterloo on Monday afternoon. Employees at Victory Motors at 2701 Falls Avenue called police at about 2:46 p.m. and reported that a neighbor put a gun to an employee's face and fired a round at the property, the State Division said in a news release Tuesday afternoon. The suspect was identified as John Piazza, 41, of Waterloo, who had been living near Victory Motors, according to the release. Employees reported that Piazza told them he would return to the business with a rifle. Waterloo Police Department officers responded to Piazza's address just behind Victory Motors and saw a man fitting the suspect description near the windows of the home. He was holding a long gun, police said. A Waterloo police officer saw Piazza allegedly point the gun at the officers and shot the suspect, the release said. Officers entered the home and found Piazza dead. The officer who filed their weapon is on critical incident leave, according to Michael Kropfel, special agent in charge of the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. The Waterloo Police Department requested the division investigate the shooting. When reached by the Des Moines Register, Waterloo Police Department officials declined to comment. The Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation will forward the results of the investigation to the Blackhawk County Attorney's Office for review upon completion. And it's just about time for us to go to the birthday music, so I think I'm going to go ahead and do that rather than going to another article. And so here we are getting ready to celebrate our birthdays.